Why work harder when you can work smarter? I mean, we're all looking for ways to make work and life just a little bit easier. Enter the Ford F-150 truck. It helps you get the job done in the smartest way possible. Have you seen the Pro Access tailgate? It improves access to the bed and cargo, which makes it easier to load in tight spaces. Think about the time and hassle you'll save with that feature alone. And I haven't even mentioned the mobile power source, Pro Power On Board. You can power up to 7.2 kilowatts outside your F-150. You're already thinking about all the ways you can put that to use, aren't you? See, I told you, smarter. Tough this smart can only be called F-150. Find your local Ford dealer at Ford.com. Pro Access tailgate available starting spring 2024. See owner's manual for important operating instructions. This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at Progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And we're talking to a cult survivor today. She's Hollywood royalty and true royalty. And she was a member of the notorious slave cult Nexium. India Oxenberg is on Talk is Jericho. And she's going to be talking about her new documentary about her experiences in Nexium. It's available now. It's called Seduced Inside the Nexium Cult. And it's exclusively on the Starz channel. Very, very well worth watching. It's an unbelievable look at the dark world of Nexium, and India is here today to share some of those details with us. She explains how she got caught up in Nexium, what founder and leader Keith Raniere was like, how she let them literally brand Keith's initials on her hip with a cauterizing pen, and what ultimately led to her escape. She talks about how instrumental her mom, actress Catherine Oxenberg, was in her leaving Nexium and has been in India's recovery. India was also in court last fall at Keith's sentencing and talks about why she needed to be there to share her experiences with the court and how she thinks her appearance impacted Keith's sentence. India's story is both scary and inspiring, as you're about to hear. So listen to India now and then check out the new documentary that she produced on Starz, Seduced Inside the Nexium Cult. But here we go. India Oxenberg and her incredible true story about surviving the Nexium cult starts now on Talk is Jericho. So thanks to Dave Schrader from Beyond the Darkness. He always hooks me up with amazing guests. And he told me about the story of India Oxenberg. And it is just an incredible story about kind of based around the documentary that you produced that I just finished watching literally minutes ago, which is called Seduce. And it is the semi-title, Inside the Nexium Cult. And this is an incredible story because I think the reason why I really took to it is like you said, you weren't like a lost soul or searching for answers or searching for the truth. It kind of something just kind of happened to you unbeknownst to you until you were in the thick of it.
So true. I mean, nobody goes looking for cults unless they're trying to investigate them and bust them open. But even as, you know, my 19-year-old self was just looking for structure. I mean, who isn't looking for structure when they're 19?
Right.
I wasn't a broken human being, that's for sure. And I don't believe that, I don't really think anybody's really broken, to be honest. I think sometimes we're just more vulnerable and we're more susceptible to certain things.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background, first of all, because you're actually royalty, Hollywood royalty and legit royalty.
It's so funny to even think about that. But yes, my grandmother is a princess of Serbia.
<That's> so
of
amazing.
Serbia. And I'm really sad because of COVID. I haven't been able to see her in a while, but we got to profile her in the series, which was amazing.
And she's amazing in it too. Yeah. She's very cool.
She's much needed comic relief.
Yeah. She seems like you said, she's actually listed as Princess Elizabeth, I believe.
That's her full name, like on her passport. No joke, is Her Royal Highness Princess Elizabeth of Yugoslavia. Like, can you imagine having to do a bubble test with that? It's like, there's no room.
No kidding.
But no, she's amazing.
So she's actually a princess. And then your mother is Catherine Oxenberg.
Correct.
Who's a very famous actress from Dynasty. I Googled all the stuff that she had done. So you came from a pretty solid background, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely unusual, that's for sure. But it was solid. I mean, I've always been surrounded by love. I have a really great, large family. And, you know, we're scattered all over the country, but we're close. And so I didn't come from a broken home. Unusual, yes, but not broken. And I was just looking for a way to carve my own path in life. And I think sometimes when you grow up with very prominent, strong personalities, people who are, you know, well developed in themselves, it can feel like, what's wrong with me? Why don't I have this shit figured out? Like, why am I so behind? But I was also only 19 and looking at my parents who had achieved such great success at a young age and was wondering, like, what's wrong with me that I haven't figured this out yet? And so I went to NACSIAM with my mother, actually, to an intro presentation, and the two of us, we're looking at it very innocently, like, oh, this could be a great way for us to bond and get to know each other well after, you know, 5 days together. And I was 19. So I was, you know, coming out of those tumultuous teenage years where you like despise your parents and just kind of entering the stage of respect and admiration and wanting to be like them, but also feeling that push and pull of wanting to individuate. So unfortunately, for us, we didn't see that NACSIAM had already kind of identified those weaknesses, because that's what they do. They target people in order to see how they could use them to benefit the company. We didn't know that. We were just looking at it like, you know, any kind of consumer taking buying a product or taking.
What was it advertised as? Like a seminar or?
Yeah, it was. So I'll explain it like this. So there's NACSIAM, which was the overarching company. Right. And then underneath it, there was all these little sub companies, one of which was called Executive Success Programs. And that's kind of their consumer front product. And they sold it as an executive seminar. So ways to improve your business, way to improve communication, ways to make a more cohesive, you know, environment for your home. So they were kind of casting a broad net of people who could afford or who were interested in personal growth.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So that's kind of how they sucked you in, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
So you went for 5 days, and then what happens after that?
Well, after that, I was approached. It's so weird to even say, because the way that I saw it versus the way that I see it now is so different, because in other words, I think I was targeted to be a coach because of my age and because of my susceptibilities at that time. But they approached both my mother and I, and they're like, oh, you should really look into the coaching program. And my mom was like, no, she, you know, she has kids, she has a career, but I was looking for something. So when they told me that this was going to be, you know, my version of a practical MBA, I thought, oh my God, this is exactly what I need. I'm missing all of these skills. I need help. Can you provide the structure and the information to get me to the next level of my life? And so I was more open, and I went down the coaching path, which then ultimately became like a full-time job without payment. And so I was investing, or I'm doing air quotes, investing in what I thought was, you know, going to be a solid education for myself, an alternative for sure, but education nonetheless.
Right. So you were investing with your time, even though you weren't getting paid.
Yeah.
You were learning skills that you could, you know, use to better yourself for sure. Let's talk a little bit right about Keith Raniere, right? Raniere?
Yeah. Keith Raniere, whatever you want to call him.
but he was kind of, obviously he was the leader of this organization. And when you first get started in all of these things in the coaching, are you having meetings with him? Have you met him yet? Is he kind of hard to get to?
Yes.
Gotcha.
So they do all of that on purpose. He's kind of like Oz in The Wizard of Oz. Oh, like you can't get to him until you actually go to Albany. because apparently he doesn't travel, which is also bullshit because we know that he fled to Mexico. So that not true. But, you know, he's being posed as this monk, as this renunciate, as this guy who, you know, is posting up in upstate New York, facing the cold weather to improve humanity. And you don't meet him until you've gone through a substantial amount of curriculum indoctrination. So by the time I met him, I was in my last 5 days of their level one course, which is 16 days total. So I went there. I was introduced to him. I was pretty unimpressed because I wasn't really going to Nexium for Keith. Like he didn't, there was, that wasn't the appeal. Oh, take courses from the smartest man in the world. Like I didn't care. I was there for myself, or at least that's what I thought.
So how long were you in Nexium before you finally met him?
Well, only a couple of months, but that meeting was, that meeting was brief. It was just sort of like, oh, you're here in Albany. Here's the founder. And he was
playing
volleyball.
Because you had to travel back and forth, right? Because you were in LA and they were based in Albany. So you would have to go back and forth there.
Yeah. It wasn't until 5 years of me being in, 5 years of me being in Nexium that I was instructed to move from LA to Albany. So that's a long time of grooming and indoctrination. And that was one of the things I really wanted to get across in the docuseries is that this stuff doesn't happen overnight. And this is, you know, this takes time. And these are people who are very aware of that. And they're invested in that because that's how these groups work. They want you in. They want you deeply in, not just on the periphery.
So when you're talking about those 5 years before you finally moved to Albany, because there's so much to talk about, and it's such an unbelievable, like you said, that they're indoctrinating you. They're playing the big picture, long-term game.
Yes, you got it.
Because like you said, if it's 5 years, that's a slow burn to slowly, I guess, brainwash you for
change your mind. Yeah, it is. It's brainwashing. But I know that sounds totally weird in sci-fi because people are like, that's not true. There can't be brainwashing, but there is. And we've seen it historically happen, you know, to governments, happen to large movements, happen to high control groups. I think we don't expect it as much in our own backyard. I think a lot of the time in America, we don't think that we are susceptible to cults because we're kind of distanced from them, or we think, oh, those are just girls dancing around wild in white dresses in the wilderness. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like, no, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about updated machines that are actually starting to use technology even more so now to recruit people.
And also too, like the initial thing is always some kind of whack job. That's the only people that join cults anyways,
right?
Like we spoke about earlier, that's not the case.
No, it's not. And oftentimes, like what we saw with Nexium, it was really high functioning people who were being changed. Like the people who went into Nexium went in with an open heart. They wanted to improve themselves. They wanted to do well. They were not the same people once they had left. They had been changed. And I think that's one of the scarier things for people to recognize and why it's so difficult for people to leave is because they have to confront that in themselves and they have to be willing to look at where they were fooled, not that they are fools. And that was my hope for the series, was that it would take away some of those stigmas.
So in the 5 years that you kind of were still going back and forth between LA and Albany, when you look back on it now, what were some of the things that were kind of instilling this control on you?
A lot of guilt. Actually, that's a really good question. And I remember feeling just so guilty about saying no to them for things that they needed. Like, oh, we need you to staff this intensive, even if it conflicted with a family birthday. Like there were just things that they were always trying to get us to prove ourselves to the organization over our other attachments in our lives that should have been a major red flag. And it just wasn't for me at the time.
And why wasn't it a red flag?
Because I thought that that's what it took to be dedicated to something.
Oh, I see.
And, you know, I thought that this was me growing up and becoming distant from the things that were holding me back. I was so confused and I didn't see how that was actually wrong.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting from reading about cults. And I remember even when I was a kid, my parents, Amway was a thing.
Oh, yes.
And I'm not sure if that was a cult per se, but it definitely had cultish.
It's still running. I just recently found out that there is a subcult within Amway that I just found this out like a week ago. So it's still functioning and it's very similar to Nexium. Like they have their consumer front and their merch. Right. And then underneath is all this nefarious activity, probably with the core group.
Great word, nefarious, by the way. Yeah. but my point was like, and they didn't stay in too long because I remember my mom saying like, it's just weird. Like just some of the people would come for the parties, like the heads of the party and very forceful and strange, but you didn't really know how, I guess crazy is not the right word, but how intense it was, how involved it was until you got up those different levels. Yeah. Same thing I've heard about Scientology. Same thing I've heard, you know, about all these different things with Nexium as well. Especially you see that in the documentary series where you don't even realize it until it's too late, and by then you're kind of too far gone to go back, right?
Right, you're too compromised, and I think that's one of the things that was hard for me to realize when I left was how many times they were testing me and testing my loyalty and how many times I actually gave them information about myself that was used against me. And that's something that's difficult to recover from because it really does affect your ability to trust people, to trust authority. And so even when I was coming out, I was still finding myself falling into traps because I was so used to a certain way of looking at the world that I had to kind of like catch up to reality. And I was behind. I like almost kind of stunted. And this is like a side, not to get too jokey or anything, but when I was in Albany, I eventually moved down to New York City because I couldn't find work up there. And I was searching desperately for a job. And I ended up working in a restaurant in the Lower East Side, the East Village specifically. Right. And I remember my coworkers teasing me about Kimmy Schmidt. And there's a series on Netflix called Kimmy Schmidt that was created by Tina Fey. And I had not seen it, obviously, at the time. And they would tease me and be like, oh, you're just like Kimmy Schmidt. And I was like, what? Then cut to a couple months later, I moved back to California and I'm, you know, at my mom's house for the first time in ages. And I decided to turn it on for some comedic relief. And I'm like, what? I am Kimmy Schmidt. I was just like so humiliated and embarrassed that I had missed this whole like pop culture thing that I was now popping into New York City from a bunker, which it wasn't really a bunker, but it kind of felt like that. And so like there's just been a lot of moments for me where I've had to like laugh about it too. As much as it is difficult, like you have to find some humor in it.
Well, absolutely, especially now that you're out the other side. You know what I mean? All right, you guys know that I travel every week for AEW, and I'm on the road for Fozzy as well. But I don't worry about appliances or any of the stuff at my house breaking down while I'm gone because we've got American Home Shield. And truthfully, I'm not a fix-it-myself guy anyway. So even if I was home and we had a leaky faucet or a faulty water heater, I'm not the one who's going to fix it. And unexpected breakdowns like that won't break your bank with American Home Shield warranty because covered repairs and replacements are taken care of just like that. You just choose a plan that works for you and your budget. And then when a covered item in your home breaks, contact American Home Shield and their trusted and qualified pros will fix or replace it based on the coverage in your agreement. Right now, you can get 20% off. Just go to ahs.com/Jericho and save that 20%. That's ahs.com/Jericho for 20% off any plan. American Home Shield, don't worry, be warranty. See ahs.com/contracts for coverage details, including limit amounts, fees, limitations, and exclusions. New Jersey residents, the product being offered is a service contract and is separate and distinct from any product or service warranty, which may be provided by the home or building manufacturer. Something that you mentioned earlier that I found very interesting was they kept requesting collateral is the word they used. Explain what that is and why they wanted you to do that.
Okay, so, and I just want to make it clear, that wasn't what was required in ESP. That was required in DOS. And DOS is the subset of the secret women's sorority.
DOS is the cult within the cult, like you said.
Exactly. The cult within the cult. That was you know, sold to us as a woman empowerment group or exclusively women coaching women in an intensified form, like having a really aggressive personal trainer who doesn't let you back down. And so I was like, sign me up. I'm a little bit extreme in that way. And I like those types of things.
Right.
And so I was already like, oh my God, that's exactly what I need. I don't want to back up out of my word. I just want somebody to push me to where I can go. And I trusted these people. So I said yes to that. And within that secret sorority, they required collateral. And collateral is just blackmail in layman's terms. And so it was information about you or your loved ones that would be damaging to your reputation, damaging to people who you loved. And sometimes, and most often, it was made up, because we're not talking about a bunch of women who are deviants with a whole bunch of secrets. We're talking about women who are going to, you know, personal growth to improve themselves, and probably 50% are vegetarian or vegans or whatever.
Right.
And so it's like not a whole bunch of, I didn't have a lot of secrets. So I was even just making things up and handing them over, trusting that this information was going to stay put as long as I kept this secret to myself and I didn't expose it or share it with anybody. And so I believed that. What I didn't realize was the more collateral we gave, the more compromised we really were, the more compromised we became, and the less likely we would be able to leave, to the point where we couldn't leave, because it would mean hurting the people we loved most or hurting ourselves.
Basically, if you left, they would release this information that
you
were molested by your father or whatever.
Exactly.
And meanwhile, that's not even true. You, for example, just made that up just for.
Yeah. And I'm, it's something that has been probably the most difficult thing to talk about, is the collateral, because it's just so screwed up. I mean, to take things that people care about and love most in order to trap them or enslave them is just really beyond cruel. And that was part of what Keith created. And he's not original in that. I mean, there's a lot of groups out there that do use similar tactics.
Yeah.
It was just something that I had to come to terms with, and then also realize how I wanted to handle it. And that meant speaking to my family, sharing the things that I had shared. And that was really hard. Even though it was fake, a lot of it, it was hard to talk about, because I put people that I love in danger. And I hate that.
Well, it's also very degrading, I think, is one of the words that you might have been looking for, because they're talking to you about, you know, and you discuss it at length in the documentary about having to take, you know, naked pictures to send to Keith, or we have to talk about Allison Mack as well, which is another subject, but she was kind of like your boss underneath Keith, right?
Yeah. And within DOS, they referred to it as a master-slave dynamic. And so she was, in that context, my master. And that was something that was really also very uncomfortable and weird as hell to try to wrap my head around. But I remember they had a justification and a reasoning for everything. So even if you felt uncomfortable about the words master-slave, they would tell you that was on purpose to provoke you in order to distance yourself from the label, or like whatever, you know, bullshit answer that they were going to get.
Right.
And, or the collateral was there to back your own words so that you wouldn't back out of a commitment or something that was challenging. So they had semi-logical answers for things that felt irrational or uncomfortable.
So, that's, you actually would have to call her. And this is just for people, like, I used to watch Smallville from time. So Allison Mack was in Smallville, a very successful actress. Once again, how the hell did she end up in this cult and now spending probably the rest of her life in jail as well? But that's another very successful person, a famous person who is in this thing, which probably helped to bring you in. Oh, well, if she's in it, then it must be okay.
It definitely lessened my guard.
Mm.
Because I was, you know, I wasn't friends with Allison before she recruited me to DOS. I actually remember just kind of seeing her in the community, and she was kind of always super bubbly, really energetic. She was excelling within Nexium, and she was becoming the person that I thought I wanted to become in that group. And so I looked up to her in that way, and I was kind of intimidated by her. But she also kind of reminded me of like those overly excited theater kids. and so I was kind of like, I don't know about you, but yeah, we'll see. And it wasn't until she really approached me more aggressively about DOS that I opened up to her. And I was telling her, like, I was in a really dark place. I was feeling really lost and vulnerable. I wasn't excelling in Nexium. And that's right when she proposed this woman's group, DOS, this sorority, to me. And that's was the beginning of a life-changing decision.
And so DOS was basically a pyramid type of a thing where Keith's on top, then he's got the first line DOS masters, and then you were yes. one of the second line DOS masters, and then for a while you had some slaves. So you had to refer to Allison as master.
Yes.
And then your slaves would have to refer to you as master.
Yeah, and I couldn't get down with that. That was so weird for me. I was like, any way that we could figure out how to work around the discomfort of the master-slave terminology, we did. Like, we used M as a way to kind of communicate with each other, because it was just so odd. And it was so hard for us to be okay with that, because it wasn't okay. And that was still part of us that was intact, that wasn't totally indoctrinated by, you know, the group. The part that was resisting is what I mean.
You had some other kind of rules and regulations that you had to follow. One of them was your diet.
Yeah.
So explain that.
Well, I'm not someone who ever dieted before. that's not really me. I always played sports, so it wasn't part of wasn't part of the deal. So I remember Allison first started, and this is once again another example of that slow drip and how things escalate. Because at first she asked me simply, have you ever dieted? Have you ever counted calories? And I was like, no, I don't count calories. I just exercise. Like,
that's right.
Part of life.
You're in shape. Exactly.
And, yeah.
Right.
And so she was like, why don't you try tracking your calories and then tell me how much you eat on a regular basis? So I tried that, reported back. Then from there, she said, why don't you try reducing some of the calories? Maybe try 1200 a day. So I was like, okay. Like, those seemed reasonable. She was telling me it was going to help me build character and discipline and, you know, work so that I wouldn't be so impulsive and things like that. She was giving me all these antidotes that seemingly seemed good and things that I might want to build in myself. Cut to, we're going to give you an extreme restricted diet, which means you can't exceed 500 calories a day. And you have to ask permission for every calorie that you're going to drink or eat and calculate it here on this chat. So my entire day is now being consumed with what I can eat and what I can't eat and when I can eat it. And if I'm being precise enough to report. So there's very little time to think about anything else when you're in starvation. And I'm sure that you can relate to this as a professional athlete, because I'm sure there are things that you've had to do that were really extreme. And it really does take over your mindset. Like, you're only focused on your weight and your food consumption, and it's crazy.
Well, especially when you were only allowed 500 calories a day. I mean, that's nothing.
That's nothing. That's basically a coffee and a muffin if you're lucky.
Right.
So I was having to, and I'm a cook, like, I'm naturally a foodie. So I was trying to figure out how I could work within this 500 calories to make it interesting or feel substantial. So, you know, you're adding spices, adding spray oil, whatever you can do to make it like feel better. So that was another one of the techniques that they used for mind control, that actually a lot of survivors of domestic abuse have reported that one of the first ways that people try to control people is through food.
Because once again, it's all about control, about being submissive.
Yes.
And this was, is this Keith wanting all you guys to be slim, skinny?
Yes.
That's what he's attracted to?
We didn't know that either. So we're being told that this is for us and our, you know, own personal discipline. And we have no idea that this is literally just for Keith's sexual desires.
Which is interesting, because you see too, he's very kissy. He's kissing everybody on the lips. Everyone's kissing him. You guys are all kissing him. And I'm making a little bit of a joke here. Like, it's not like it's freaking Brad Pitt or something. It's just some normal kind of dweeby looking guy with bad hair. I hate his hair. I just wanted to part of it. I just wanted to cut it. It's like, oh, it's terrible. But that's the control that he's expanding upon you.
Yeah, and that translates to, you know, restricted sleep, restricted food, restricted exposure to other people outside of the group. It's just one more level of control that makes adding other more severe levels of control become normalized.
Now, how was it for you? And once again, you talk about it in depth in the film, but you mentioned, you know, having to get thin and skinny for Keith's, you know, sexual, you know, attractive. That's what he likes. So you had to have sexual experiences with him, as did pretty much all of the members of DOS at one point, right?
Yeah, a lot of them. I couldn't tell you how many, because one of the things that we were not allowed to do was talk to each other about any of the experiences that we had with Keith. So I didn't know that while I was being abused, other women were being abused too. And similarly to me. And so that was one of the ways that he was able to keep his secret going, was just kind of siloing people.
Nobody knew for sure what everyone else was doing.
No, that's kind of like very mobster.
Well, once again, though, like you said, you know, now you're very, very much indoctrinated into the cult. But even when something like that's happening, if it's basically, you know, a form of rape in a lot of ways, and you even talk, it's not something you ever feel good about or get anything out of. Deep down inside, isn't your animal instincts like, this is wrong, I should probably not be doing this and get the fuck out of here? Or
yeah, but at that point, I mean, your intuition and like your connection to, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, your soul or your spirit or yourself has been kind of dwindling over time. So it's hard to connect to that when you're in that state of fear, especially. And so I remember there were many times where I would say, like, whenever we're together, I feel this horrible feeling inside my chest, and like earnestly sharing with him, thinking that maybe he would help me figure out what was going on or why I felt so uncomfortable. And he would just turn to me and say, that's your problem. And so I actually believed that. Wow. I really did believe that this was my problem, that maybe I would never feel good with sex. Maybe I would never feel good with an intimacy or a partner. I thought maybe I was totally asexual. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't know what to think, because I was being taught to believe that my instincts were wrong.
They're taking away all of your self-worth as well.
Yeah. And you come out of these things. And that's why I have so much respect for anyone who has left either a domestic abuse situation or a high control group, because the amount that it takes to leave and to start to look at what your life really was versus what you were taught to think it was, it takes a lot of courage.
Like, once again, there's so much to think about here. And
I know.
Once again, like, the fact that you made this documentary is amazing, because it's all out there, and it must have been very difficult to do, but also very important. And I'm sure that's probably the reason why you wanted to do this.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there are many reasons I wanted to do it, and there are many reasons why I didn't want to do it. in the beginning, too, I just wasn't ready for a while to talk about this stuff. So I took some time and I began to write, and that felt a lot safer and controlled. And then when I was approached by Cecilia Packin and Paul Lesner, and I saw their track record of documentaries that they had made, and I just felt like there couldn't be a better place for me to share my story and have the opportunity to take my life back into my own hands, because the media had kind of, you know, gone wild with it. And I was just branded sex slave cult girl all over Google. And I was like, how am I going to come back from this? Like, how am I going to, what am I going to do? Change my name, run away to the mountains, like ditch my life? That's not an option, although I had thought about it.
Well, once again, like, your name is very unique. It's not like your name is, you know, Deborah Jones or something. It's pretty hard to forget India Oxenberg.
I know. It's a weird, it's so weird. And it's like, at first I remember talking to my then boyfriend, now fiance. I was like, what do I do? Should I change my name?
No.
And he was like, no. Now I love my name. I feel very proud of my name now.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
We'll talk about some of that once you leave, because there's some very interesting things that happen to you. But just as we're talking about some of the things, the submissive things, and once again, there's, we talked about the naked pictures, and they want close-ups of your, you know, your private parts, and you're getting paddled and all these different things. But the one that really stands out to me is the branding. And that one, that's when you watch that part, just thinking about it. Like, I have a lot of tattoos, and you know, it's a different thing completely. This is actually getting branded like a cow, like a cattle, like a piece of, like a, you know. So explain that to us.
Okay. So yes, it is incredibly different from tattoos. I have a couple tattoos myself, and I literally laughed when I got the tattoos, because they're so just not painful compared to the brand. And we didn't have any anesthesia, no numbing cream, no nothing. And it was done with a cauterizing pen, actually, like not the cattle prod that you imagine on a ranch where like a cow is being, because that is what a lot of people imagine, but this is more precise. This is something that was done by a doctor, actually, who was inside of the group.
It's actually a pen that is, you know, 1,000 degrees Burned or whatever, you. And they draw the symbol on you. But just to go back, saying why did you have to get this brand, and what was the situation surrounding it?
So the brand was only spoken to us when we were recruited initially. And I remember Allison kind of like glazing over it real quick. And she said something like, yeah, there's going to be a brand or a tattoo. It's going to be really small, but it will be something that will help to ensure that you guys are loyal and pledging to the group, kind of like a pledging in a sorority or a fraternity. And so that's where my mind went. And I was like, okay, I can handle that. Like, sure. Is that the worst of it? I had no idea what that was actually going to entail. So cut to, you know, months later and hundreds of articles of collateral that you've already submitted. Sleep deprivation, calorie deprivation, and we're in January 2017, I believe, and I was the first woman to be branded by Dr. Danielle Roberts. And I just remember that day, like, kind of feeling like I was out of my body. And I said to Allison, like, are you sure we have to do this? I remember just like one moment where I questioned it, and she said yes. Like, the option to say no was not there.
It's mandatory, yeah.
Yeah, and that had been removed. And then in order to make it kind of tolerable, I think the women, including myself, we had to imagine that this was going to be a positive bonding experience for us, that this was going to be something that was going to draw us together, like Navy SEALs going and getting a tattoo. Like, we were going to do something tough and challenging, and it was going to prove our loyalty. And that was kind of the mindset that I had transitioned into, away from being terrified. Right. And it took about 30 minutes to complete. That's when I realized that this was going to be a lot larger than I had thought. And we were told that the brand was a symbol of the elements. We were never, ever told that they were Keith Raniere's initials until afterwards.
And you can't see it until they pointed out the documentary, because they kind of put it on this way. But if you look on the side, you can see the K and the R.
Exactly.
And once again, this is with a cauterizing pen, basically torturing you as they are, like you said, this is not the size of a quarter. It's more the size of your hand, or, you know, your palm of your hand, right?
Like your palm. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So once you get that, I mean, how long does it take before the pain starts to go away? Cause like you said, you had no anesthesia. This is legit torture.
No. Yeah. This took, I mean, when it was happening, I think because the nerves had been burned, I didn't feel until it hit certain nerve endings close to my bone and my hip. And then you would get a jolt of pain, like a nerve spasm almost. And so it took a couple months for it to heal fully. I think it was, so it turned into February, February, March, March, April. Yeah. So about 3 months where it wasn't raw.
Oh my gosh.
Like, the scar had kind of
solidified or whatever. Yeah.
I know. Healed and solidified. Yeah. And it was like a couple weeks where it was really sensitive, very oozy. And I remember having to like clean it in a in the shower and just like watch the plasma fall off of it. It was disgusting. And on top of it, we were told that we had to send photographs of it progressively healing to Danielle. And we didn't know that those were also going to Keith. Like he was tracking us like a human science experiment.
That's unbelievable. And there's a very moving scene in the movie, if you call it that. But when you went to the doctor afterwards to see if you could basically get it, you know, the plastic surgeon to get it removed. And he was saying that it would take up to a year to try and do it properly.
Yeah, I wasn't willing to do that. I felt like I had already done enough. I mean, going back and working with the FBI for 9 months, every couple of weeks, I just couldn't imagine also having to go through surgery over and over again.
You got a nice tattoo.
I did. I ended up tattooing it instead.
That's great. Well, it's also like a battle scar too for you to, you know, totally. you can own it now, like you mentioned. Let's talk about how you left and kind of the breaking down of the entire cult. Because like you said, even in the documentary, it took a while. Even when Keith is up on charges and in jail, you're still, you know, loyal to him.
It took a long time. And I mean, I wish I could say that it happened like that and that all of a sudden, you know, the glass broke and I saw the truth.
Right.
And that's just not how it was for me at all. It was stages of seeing the truth and kind of coming to terms with reality and in my own pace. And I worked with a deprogrammer after I had left that my mom had introduced me to. And she helped me tremendously to just re-engage my critical thinking because it had been so tampered with. When you're in a group like that, oftentimes you're taught to think circularly. So you're in a closed loop of thinking and you can't actually think outside of the logic of the group. So the deprogrammer, even though that sounds super weird, helps you to get back to yourself and also to your ability to think more logically and objectively. So she did that for me. I left in February, Keith, of 2018. I left Albany, went to New York City. Keith was arrested in March. Allison was arrested in April. All of that time, I'm trying to keep a job and it's getting crazy because the paparazzi are chasing me around. And I'm like, oh my God, please get out of my underwear drawer. Leave me alone. I'm just trying to survive. And at that point, wasn't really communicating with my mom. That only started to open up that summer after those arrests. And then we began to have an open dialogue again, which was really important to me and also really challenging for both of us.
Well, because the whole time your mom was trying to get you out of there.
Yeah. And my mom was fighting for me and they were telling me that she was a psychopath and that she was trying to hurt me. And I had a lot of distrust for my mom. And so we've had to work double time to rebuild that and get back to being teammates again, which has been wonderful. But
because that's another
it was hard.
That's another tendency of the cult to try and separate you from the ones that you love and family.
Family,
right?
Yeah. Anyone who can challenge the loyalty to the group is someone who would be considered a threat to a group.
Gotcha.
Like that. And obviously, my loyalty was to my family, but it was being compromise and it was being really tested and for a long time I fell deeper into the group before I really got out. So I got out that summer. I ended up leaving New York City, moving back to California, and starting to kind of reconnect with my family and start to heal and take care of myself and do normal things, nice things, be home. And that was hard because as I was separating myself more from the cult and from New York, I was experiencing a lot of PTSD and memories and things that would just like come to me in the night or panic attacks. And I was kind of getting back to feeling again, but feeling again comes with memories. And I think anybody who's experienced any kind of trauma knows that memories can be fractured and disjointed and that they can come in a wave. All of a sudden you can be triggered and you're like, oh my God, how did I forget that? And you have the memory back and it feels like it's happening. And so I was going through a lot of that for a couple months as well as working with the FBI.
I can only imagine how bad that would be. And I want to ask you, was Keith like, was he like a godlike figure to you? Was he a father figure? Was he a romantic figure? All of the above? None of the above?
He was like a mentor, like I was his student and he was a teacher and I thought he was my friend. I really believed that he was my friend. I didn't feel so romantic with him. I think I had to kind of play that role a little more just to make sure I wasn't going to upset anybody. But I never wanted to be his girlfriend. Like, that wasn't ever what I aspired to. And there were plenty of people who really wanted that.
Mm-hmm. So when you mentioned that Keith got arrested, what kind of finally brought the NXIVM down?
Oh, so many brave people. I mean, there were so many people who left even before I did that started this wave of bringing NXIVM to justice. And a lot of that was spearheaded by my mother and in the media, especially in the most recent years, and the defectors that she worked with, who are just incredibly strong. And so it took a lot. It took a lot of people. It took a government investigation. I mean, it took years for this man to be held accountable because he has been doing this for decades.
Well, and he also had something that we have to mention too, is he had the funding from the Bronfman sisters, who are the heirs to the Seagram's liquor, you know, fortune, right?
Exactly. I mean, without their money, I don't think he would have been nearly as successful.
But they have hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's kind of what he was siphoning it from, right?
Yeah, and they bankrolled all of his endeavors. Hmm.
So when you kept saying that you were working with the FBI, what exactly is it that you were doing? Because there's a point in the movie as well where you could be brought up on charges potentially. That was a theory and an issue too.
Yeah, and that was a really scary time for me because I didn't know and I had a lot of uncertainty about what was going to happen to me.
Right.
In this whole situation. And thank God that decision of victim and perpetrator is not my choice and that is the government's choice to figure out based on tons of evidence where they draw the line. And they drew the line from first line slaves to up towards Keith. And then below that was more or less victims of this lie that stemmed from Keith.
So the first line of the DOS masters and Keith were eligible and the second line were not, right?
Because of what they knew.
Gotcha.
And what they concealed from us. So we were tricked into saying yes to something.
It's interesting too, because you had your slaves that they disappeared when all the stuff went down, but there was, and you never wanted to do it. But if you had participated in their branding, you might've been, you know, in big trouble.
And I think that's exactly, and I know that's why my mom stepped in, because there was a line that she knew that if I crossed,
gotcha,
it could be too dangerous for me and I might not be able to come back from that. My mom was able to see that and I was not.
Yeah.
And so, and what I mean by working with the FBI is I was a cooperating witness amongst many others who also helped. And at the last minute, I was pulled from testifying because Lauren Salzman, Nancy Salzman's daughter, who's the CEO of ESP and NXIVM, she testified and she was a first line DOS slave. And so that kind of let me off the hook to having to be cross-examined by Keith's lawyers and all of the other things that my friends had to go through in order to get on the other side of it.
Mm.
So I got lucky there.
So Keith is guilty of all the charges. And I think he's sentenced just recently to 120 years in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Allison Max is 40 years. Bronfman's got 7 years, whatever it may be.
Yeah, Allison hasn't been charged yet, though.
Gotcha. Oh, gotcha.
So we're waiting for that. I actually went to Keith's sentencing. It was in October during the press tour of Seduced. And I had no idea that the timing of his sentence was going to fall in that time. And so I was like, I got to go. I'll be back in 24 hours. Like, I need to go speak and then I'll see you guys when I get home. But that was really intense. And I mean, I was one of 15 other people who spoke that day. And the judge started off by saying that he was going to give him 58 years, but because his lack of empathy or remorse, he ended up giving him 150 after everybody spoke.
Wow. So you guys actually went to
a lot.
You went to the courtroom prior to the sentencing and told your story?
No, I did it on that day. So how they do it is when they're sentenced, when somebody is sentenced, people have the right to share their victim impact statements.
Okay.
And that's what I did with a group of other men and women. Some of them were remote through video, but I felt like for me, because I didn't testify at trial, I needed that closure for myself. I just needed to say my piece and walk the F out of there and say, you're staying and I'm going.
Right.
And that felt really good. And I honestly, like, that night was probably one of the first nights that I slept and I wasn't afraid.
That, 'cause you knew that the monster was gone, right?
Yeah. It just, like, it still makes me teary now because, like, I didn't know what to expect from that experience. I just knew, I was like, I'm just going to do it. Like, just go. Just buy. It's like when you have to buy the ticket and take the plunge because
right.
you know that you might chicken out. I was like, okay, India, like, just go there and get it done.
It probably helped, though. Like you said, you mentioned your friends, all the people that survived this with you. It actually reminds me a lot of the Jeffrey Epstein documentary that I watched a few months ago where those survivors became very close friends and were testifying as well.
Yeah, they gave me a lot of strength.
Mm-hmm. Do you still keep in touch with them and talk to them?
Some of them, yeah. Yeah, actually, some of them, because of what we've gone through, have become my closest friends. Some of them I've left behind, but there are a couple who were really close.
When you see, like, people, because NXIVM is not completely disbanded, right? They're still, it's still limping along.
I like that description. I'd like to think that.
Yes.
But yes, there are still loyalists to Keith and to NXIVM, people who still believe that his teachings and the company is good. And that just makes me really sad because I remember when I felt that strongly like they have, but that was, you know, before this whole investigation and the closure and the sentencing. So it's hard for me to believe that they're still believing, but I also know how difficult it is to change your beliefs about something that you're so devoted to. So I can understand them a little bit better, but I also just feel sad, like they're missing out on their lives because they're still trying to defend this guy.
You mentioned earlier, like when this was going down, you were kind of, no pun intended, branded as the, like, sex slave, like you said, cult girl. And you mentioned that.
Yeah, not a good look.
Right.
Not a good look.
It was
look.
Hard for you to get an apartment or to get a job. And that's just because people were just assuming because you were there that you're this evil, crazy person type thing?
Yeah, whatever. They were assuming whatever they wanted, but it was difficult. It was almost impossible for me to get an apartment, actually. And I kept applying, but everybody Googles you. And I just kept thinking, like, I just didn't know how to deal with that. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how I was going to be able to take... I just didn't know how I was going to move forward from it. And so, yeah, it was definitely a challenge.
So how did you move forward from it?
First, I focused on myself and getting back to my family and healing and making sure that I had clarity on what had happened in the past 7 years of my life. And that I also was being honest with myself about how I participated, how I was fooled, how I had been manipulated, and the things that I liked as well, because it's like, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's better to kind of go through and piece by piece and figure it out, because these things are complex and people's lives are complicated. It's not just black and white. So I had to do a lot of soul searching in that sense. And then I had to focus on my health. And that included, like, food and exercise and getting my muscle back, which I had, like, totally lost. And that's taken, like, a couple years to rebuild. Mm. So I feel really strong now, and I've gotten into boxing quite heavily. It's like my therapy. And I just love being able to just punch the shit out of something when I feel like I can't express myself.
You got to put Keith's face on the sparring pads.
I've put more than Keith's face on the sparring pads before in my mind. and so that's been huge for me. And then also being able to write. I wrote a book that is exclusive for Audible, where I just kind of shared my whole internal process, like a journal, more or less. And then working on this docuseries was incredibly reinvigorating. And it just kind of opened my eyes to a world of activism that is very important for me to be involved in and for my own healing. And also just, it's like someone said something to me while we were actually doing the docuseries about how like true healing comes from being able to give back the lesson that you've learned. Mm-hmm. And that's been something that I think has been really helpful for me.
Well, even it's like your grandma, the Princess Elizabeth, says towards the end where she says, you know, maybe this was your destiny and you came out of this as a better person. Maybe you were, everything happens for a reason, that sort of thing. And maybe this is your destiny to be able to tell the story so that other people don't fall into the same trap.
I like to look at things like that too. Mm-hmm. I like to see things as having a reason and like having a greater reason, maybe beyond our little selves.
Right.
That is more about our soul and about like our life's purpose. And I like to look at things like that. It makes me feel a lot better about mm-hmm. the experiences that I went through and that they were worth something and that they have a reason and a purpose. But I also know that there's a lot more out there. And I think my mom saw a life for me that I didn't see for myself while I was still inside of the group. And so I really want to take advantage of that lost time.
But like you said too, though, the 7 years is also a long time. You were 19, so you kind of grew up in that cult. So I'm sure there's things you learned from it, both good and bad, that you can use for the rest of your life as well.
Totally.
You know? With the last few things, so with the documentary, like, because I have 14-year-old teenage daughters, twins.
Wait, you have
no 14-year-old twin daughters.
Okay, you have two twins.
Yeah, twins. Yeah.
Okay.
And I want them to watch this just to, you know, so they can see kind of how easy it is to fall into this kind of a trap. What are you hoping that people get out of your docuseries?
I hope it's just that.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that that the warning signs and the red flags are clear so that we can protect the people that we love and the people who might be vulnerable or might not have had enough hard knocks in the world to know better. And I hope that this docuseries also leaves people with a lot more compassion and that they can see how this could happen to anyone and that it doesn't make you wrong or bad or anything, that it just is part of some people's experience.
You mentioned that you have a fiance now. How was that for you and for him? I mean, you mentioned having a lot of PTSD and all that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's the best. And he's a big fan of yours, by the way.
Cool.
When I told him, he was like, oh my God, Mike, I love that guy. And I was like, yeah, it's going to be fun.
That's great.
And so he's so normal. He's from Philly. We met in New York City. He's a chef, which is awesome because I love to eat and we cook together often. And so he really helped me to just kind of have fun and be normal. And obviously there were moments in our relationship where I was resentful of the things that he had in college or with his friends or the parties, and we're the same age. So oftentimes he would tell a story about college and I would be like, where was I that year?
Right.
I was like, oh, I was in Nexium, like doing bullshit courses, and I would feel really angry and like hurt about it. And I had to kind of let that go and just be like, no, it's okay. You didn't lose everything. You just didn't have that. But yeah, we've had our challenges and he's pretty private. So I've tried to keep him out of the media as much as possible, just out of respect for him, because he didn't ask for this. Mm-hmm. He asked for me. Mm-hmm. And so it comes with the territory and he's fully supportive of that. But he also knows that he likes to have some time away from Nexium. He doesn't associate me with Nexium.
Which is great.
And that's kind of like why our relationship works. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting too. I'm sure when this movie came out that you did do a lot of press because of your lineage and your legacy within Hollywood. You know, Catherine Oxenberg's daughter, I'm sure everyone wanted to talk to you as a result.
Oh, yeah. And I didn't realize how much interest we were going to generate. And so my mom and I ended up doing a lot of the interviews together, which was great. And it was like a real bonding experience for us, like a real bonding experience.
Literally, yeah. So last question for you. So what do you have in the future? What are your plans and how do you want to continue to kind of spread this message?
Well, I'm working on a foundation with my mom that's already in existence. It's called the Katherine Oxenberg Foundation, and that is there to ensure that there's resources for therapy for anybody who leaves a high control group or a coercive environment. And so that's something that I'm really motivated to build because we just need more. And there's only probably 20 therapists in the US who are qualified to treat people who have left these types of traumas. So there's a lack of resources. And so I'm pretty dedicated to bringing more fundraising and putting together other organizations to just make this work. I want there to be a safety net for people so that they don't come out of a group and then have to be destitute or retreat back into something because they don't have support outside of it. So there's that. I'm looking to start writing again because I love it. So I'm writing a proposal for book two. Great. So I hope that that goes somewhere, and just kind of living my life and rolling with the punches of COVID and all of the glories that come with it.
Yeah, right.
And so we're just trying to figure out what our next move is. Maybe go spend some time with my fiance's family back east. We're with everybody else trying to figure it out day by day.
The world is your oyster now. And also, too, I read that your mom is like 3,563 in line for the throne. So
there's that.
Suddenly she becomes the Queen of England. Then you got that going for you, too.
Oh, my God. I don't know if I could handle that. After Nexium and the fires and the this, I'm like, no. Right. Let's everybody just take it easy. I want to just go to a farm and have a homestead or something. Have my own chickens.
Grow your own eggs. India, it's great to talk.
Simple,
easy. It's great talking to you, and what an amazing story. And you're a true survivor and very inspirational.
Likewise. Thank you so much. And I hope that your girls can watch the series and that it's helpful for them too.
For sure. I'll make them watch it. All they do is watch YouTube anyway. So watch this for a while.
Thank you for having me. It was so great to meet
you. Hopefully get to meet in person one of these days.
I know. Fingers crossed.
Especially for your fiance.
Yeah. Oh my God. He would die.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.